We're doing Parshat Mishpatim. Our Parsha has many, many mitzvot, so if you want a quick overview of the Parsha, look at previous years. This year, we're going to try to just go through the Parsha step by step. There's so much to discuss that every year there are different points that we stress, and this year is going to be no different in the fact that it will be different. Ve'la Mishpatim, the idea of justice. I want to try, you guys are Baruch Hashem a very good group, so I want to try to talk very quickly, and if you see I'm talking too quickly, slow me down, okay? There was an argument a century ago about whether we should all be communists or not. The argument is still standing. Go check North Korea. At any rate, Rav Hirsch and Rav Henkin both addressed the idea, and really they're not saying new concepts, but rather old concepts that are illustrated in our parsha. The importance of Mishpatim, a justice system, is that every person knows what's his and what's not. Mishpatim are necessary. Justice is necessary in order to maintain peace and ambition within society. As Rav Hirsch writes, the Mishnah can tell you that a pious person says, what's mine is readily available for you, provided that the sentence begins with, what's mine, that I have ownership. If I have ownership, then I can make it readily available to you. A society where I do not have ownership, a communal society, cannot succeed long term. And so the Torah gives us a system in our parsha. Now the Torah gives us a system which protects the poor, which protects a person when he hits a financial meltdown. So the Torah begins with discussing a person who cannot make ends meet. Either we have a Hebrew servant because he was caught stealing and he cannot pay for what he stole, or a Hebrew servant because he sold himself. What does it mean to sell oneself into slavery? It means losing all control over your time. If you're married, then the master can tell you to sleep with his shifcha kenanis, to bring him slave children from the non-Jewish woman who was also went into slavery. So the Torah is if one is married, then the master can also tell the servant that on his nights he wants him to spend it with this female servant. So he loses control over his life. So some people want someone to take control of their lives. There's a tremendous weakness. Sometimes people say, tell me what to do. There was a girl for her doctorate in Tel Aviv, a non-religious girl. She decided she wants to explore the following. She put an ad in the paper and said, I'm looking to hire someone for free to do some simple housework, cleaning my house. Anyone interested, call this number. People called. Top professionals called. People called. When interviewed, she hired them. They worked cleaning her house. And after a period, she would interview them. And this is what she wrote her doctorate about. Why are you interested in doing this? And they discussed the idea that they needed someone to tell them what to do. There were these big bosses, hotshot CEOs, and they felt like they needed a segment of their life where they were not the ones in charge, where someone else was in charge. If I didn't see it, I wouldn't believe it. So this weakness can sometimes reach extreme levels. And so the Torah's against that. The Torah is all about making decisions, living by our decisions, standing up for our decisions, and if we erred, then fixing our decisions. The Torah is against this idea, and that's why the first mitzvah in Mishpatim is how does a Hebrew slave go free? Because the Torah is about freedom. The Torah is about making decisions, and that's what life is about. So the first mitzvah addresses the social net, which is called the servant system, where a person can say, that's it, I can't handle it, I lost my assets, I'm bankrupt, I need help. And when a person sells himself as a servant, so what happens is the master takes over taking care of his wife, the master takes over taking care of his children. By the way, this is where the Torah addresses the financial responsibility towards children. Because the Torah tells us that the master must take care of the servant's children. From here we infer, from here we derive the concept that every parent must take care of his children financially at least till the age of 6. It is derived from this mitzvah. Because the master is taking over the servant's responsibilities. So from here you understand that before he became a servant, one of his responsibilities were to fund his children. Now what happens after age 6, by the way? It's not like you tell your kid, hey, son, you're on your own. No, the courts will beat you up. But the biblical obligation is still age 6. From age 6 onward, it's considered a kindness that a parent owes his child. And the halachic relevance is that you can sometimes use your tzedakah money to fund your children past age 6. Because the assumption is that the kid could really fund his own breakfast, lunch, and supper. You tell, I had a friend who used to do this. They weren't well off. And at night, every kid would spend an hour or two counting nuts and bolts and putting them in little plastic bags and stapling them shut. And this was child labor, but no one knew about it. So the kids would make, you know, they'd get paid like 3 cents a bag, 5 cents a bag. But they could put together in a bag, they could make like 20, 30, 40 bags an hour. And then they ended up adding to the family paycheck. And it made a difference. You see, he did it. So technically, one could have his kids doing things that would fund their expenses. You could have the kid have a root giving out a newspaper. You could have the kid having a simple job. And when you're funding your children past age 6, so that's considered an act of kindness that every parent owes his child, but it's still an act of kindness. And again, the halachic relevance is that there will be instances where you could use your tzedakah money, your ma'aser money, for your child's tuition or for your child's food and clothing, etc. The Torah describes that the only time that a master can give a Hebrew servant, this female servant, to procreate and bring children to the world is provided that the Hebrew servant is married. Now that seems counterintuitive, but the idea is this female servant is a non-Jewish woman. She became a servant. And the Torah allows you to use the Hebrew servant to bring more servants to the world. But the Torah didn't want him to get attached to this girl. And the Torah knew that the nature of a human being is that he gets attached to someone he's intimate with. And even if he didn't mean it, even if he wasn't attracted, even if he had zero interest, but over time, that's the nature of things. So the Torah said you could only give him if he was married, if he's married when he entered the relationship. Now, when the Torah describes a person being married or single, the Torah describes being single as having his wing by his side. Meaning being married is described as spreading your wing. From here we have this concept, which appears in many places, that a husband is considered like he's spreading his wing over his wife. And that's why in some communities the custom is that the chassan takes his talis and drapes it over the kala when she comes in under the canopy. Some say that's the chuppah, the draping of the talis over the kala, because he's technically taking her under his wing. Yes, Aviel?
Quick question, I'm probably foolish about this. The non-Jewish slave has to be a single woman.
Yeah. Now, what does it mean, a non-Jewish slave? So when a Jewish owner purchases a non-Jewish servant, he tells the servant, here's the deal. You have 12 months to decide if you want to convert to Judaism. If you want to convert, then you will have a conversion that's called a special conversion to become a Jewish servant. You will circumcise if you're male. You will go to mikveh. And you will do this all with the intent of accepting mitzvot in the realm that a servant is responsible to accept mitzvot. Meaning you're not completely obligated. A male non-Jewish servant, even though he does gear, he does this technical gear, he's only obligated in mitzvot like a Jewish woman. He's not obligated in all mitzvot. And you can understand that they weren't too good about it, these servants. Meaning a non-Jewish servant that was bought by a Jew would have an interest to remain under the Jew because there are many laws in the Torah protecting the non-Jewish servant. If he says, I'm not interested in this Torah business. I like bowing to Zeus. I like eating my pork. I'm not interested in giving up on crab. I know you don't feed me crab often, but if I have a non-Jewish master, so every so often, he won't care if I hunt cats and eat them. You know, when the cats get killed here on the street, so the Philippine workers pick them up and make them for supper. It's well known. if you don't want to call the iriyah, the city, to pick up the cat, the carcass that's lying near your house, just call one of the Philippine workers. Very often they'll be happy to take it for supper. So the servant can say, my master doesn't like, he's not going to feed me lamb chops every night. But if I remain non-Jewish, then I can go and eat as much cats as I want. I could eat mice. I could eat whatever I want. What do I need these mitzvos for? So he's entitled to say, I don't want it. And he has 12 months to make up his mind. Now, if he becomes a Jew, he's responsible for mitzvos like a woman. So he can't do any prohibition. He can't do work on Shabbos. He can't eat leaven on Pesach. He's responsible like a woman. He has to eat kosher. But he also has laws that protect him. He has. There are many mitzvot that discuss protection of a Jewish servant, of a non-Jewish servant. So he might opt in. He might opt out. He's given 12 months. If he opts in, he undergoes this gir procedure. If he will become a freed servant, then he'll have to undergo gir again, because it's not a complete gir, it's not a complete conversion. But this is technically what happens with this woman. Now, with the man or woman.
But
yeah.
The woman, if she was married, that would be a illicit relationship, right? So that's what I'm saying. If you have a, that's what my question was, if you have a Jewish slave, and you say, you know, I want more workers, you sleep with this non-Jewish slave that I have. He can't be a one who's married even to another non-Jew. Isn't that part of the Noahite thing, sexual morality and things?
Right. But I didn't go into detail because going into detail would take too much time.
Okay.
We have too much to discuss. It's, you're right in your direction of thought. When it comes to the details, there's too much to discuss.
16-year-old slaves who are married, that you could think they would buy to do that.
Yeah. Now, what happens if the servant says, at the end of his time, he says, I want to stick around? So that's against Jewish theology. The Torah doesn't want it. And that's why the Torah has a special punishment that he has his ear pierced by the doorpost, and this is something he'll go around with his whole life. Now, maybe I should tell you something off the record. So I hope the females listening to this can pause or just shut off the volume. Now you know everyone's going to listen, right? Once you say that, that's it. They're all listening. But it says that in ancient times, the only people who wore earrings, who had their ears pierced, were servants. The one Medrash even says that the idea that women like getting their ears pierced is part of the curse of Eve. That there used to be equality between man and woman. And when Adam and Eve sinned in the Garden of Eden, so then man was given his load to deal with, woman was given her load to deal with. And one of the issues that women have to contend with is that in certain realms they're weaker than men. And within the marital relationship, there's an imbalance of powers. There is. We have different strengths, and it's very often to the woman's detriment, the imbalance of powers. Go check the stats of single mothers and single fathers. Why is it that the father has to pay alimony? Why doesn't the mother walk out of the marriage and say, you go deal with the kids, honey. I'm going to Honolulu. It's a rarity. It happens once in 500 cases. But a husband, oh yeah, he's out. And how many deadbeat dads are there out there? So there is an inequality within the relationship. Even in a non-religious relationship, Hashem made it that emotionally, personally, we're different. And that difference is very often to the woman's detriment. And the Medrash says that's one of the reasons that they started piercing their ears. It connects to the idea that slaves would pierce their ears. Now, don't go telling your wives that. My wife never heard this Medrash from me. So don't go telling your wives this Medrash. But this idea that we're going to pierce the servant's ear, it goes back to the beginning of creation, where servants, from the beginning of time, would have their ears pierced. And this guy, God says, I want you to deal with life. And the servant says, no, let the master deal with life. I don't want to deal. So that's why he gets his ears pierced. Because until that point, we say, you're an Eved Ivri. And even though the term Ivri is a derogatory term, it doesn't say Eved Yehudi, Eved Yisrael. It's Eved Ivri. The term Hebrew is a derogatory term. But the idea is you're getting out of it. Once he says, I want to prolong it, so then he voluntarily continues his tenure as a servant, so then he gets his ear pierced. We're saying you're branded. That's a faulty trait. Now, the Torah has another issue which we have to discuss, and that is that a father has control over his daughter. Whenever we see control in Torah, control is synonymous with responsibility to do good. Anytime you see the concept of control in Torah, the idea is you have the responsibility to do good for the person you have control over. So if within the marital relationship, a husband is given more control over the finances, then the halacha demands that a husband takes better care of his wife than himself. That control is synonymous with the responsibility to do more good unto others. If the king has more control, then the king has more responsibility to do good. And this, you'll see it throughout the Torah. So the same is true with regards to a father and a daughter. When the Torah gave the father the control to marry off his daughter, what is the Torah saying? So you have to come with me to the city of Krakow 800 years ago. The Crusaders are coming. People are getting killed right and left. And a father's sitting there shaking with his family, and he doesn't know if he's going to live to take care of his daughters. If you go through Jewish history, there were so many pogroms that parents were concerned, and rightfully so, that they would never live to take care of their daughters. Now what happens with a little girl who has no one to take care of her? She's going to end up on the streets, she's going to end up being violated, she's going to end up being taken advantage of. You have to realize that there were many orphans, were the first generation that they doesn't really have orphanages. go up the block, go see that huge building, a whole block long, Diskin. You guys see that building? Just go up the block, take a right, you walk out of the yeshiva, go up the block, past the light, continue straight. When you hit the dead end on your left side, you walk down a little alleyway, and you'll see a building that's a whole block long. That whole building was an orphanage. They had maybe 300-400 orphans in that building for over a century. That building was packed with hundreds of orphans just from Jerusalem. So we read about orphanages, it seems like something, oh, who's ever heard of that? But up until this century, orphanages were packed. And Jews had a greater percentage of orphans because we were being maimed and killed and attacked right and left. So the Torah said, in order to protect one's daughters, the Torah gave control to a father that he could marry off the girl in order to ensure that she's taken care of. And this, even now, there are women alive today from the Sephardi communities where the Muslims would come in and say, any girl that's not wed is being taken to forced conversion to marry a Muslim. And this was true throughout many of the Sephardi communities, and that's why there was a custom quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, quoted in Tosfos, and this spanned all of the Jewish exile. The different communities had to implement this at different times, but people would take their daughter when she was 6, 7, 8, and marry her off to someone. She'd grow up in her father's house, but she was legally wed to someone, and that protected the girls from the Muslims. They wouldn't touch a girl that was legally wed, and that protected the girls in the times of the Crusades. A person could know that his daughter was taken care of. There was a guy who was looking out for her, so one of them is going to live, the father or the guy, but someone's going to look out for the girl. So this idea that the Torah gave the father control over his daughter to marry her off, well, the Talmud says, cursed is a person who marries his daughter when she's a minor. The Talmud says, you're not allowed to do that. Wait until she's old enough to see who she likes. And she says, Biploni ani rotza, I want to marry so-and-so. So Tosfos on the spot asks, then why are we all marrying off our girls at 6, 7, 8? And Tosfos answers, because we don't know that we're going to live it out to see them hit the age of 12. We have no reason to assume we're going to live that long given the dangerous circumstances we're in. So that's why you have this dual nature. The Torah says on the one hand, it's a terrible father who would marry off his daughter as a minor. On the other hand, the Torah gave him that legal authority because there were instances in different communities at different times where that was the way to save a girl. Now what happens when the father, he's ill and impoverished, no one wants to marry his daughter? There are plenty of girls out there to be married. And he can't get his daughter married. So the Torah gave us another venue in our parsha. The Torah said the father could sell his daughter as a servant. So the man comes to the wealthy person in town and tells him, look, I have a 6-year-old girl. Do me a favor. I don't have food in my house. I can't feed her. Can you buy her? Take her as a servant. She'll clean the toilets every day. She'll feed your little ones. Take her in. I can't feed her. She's going to die at home. The Torah gave a parent the capacity to sell his daughter as a servant in order to protect the girl. And what happens then is, let's say the guy pays him 100 shekel. He's not going to pay a lot because he's taking in a liability. This is a girl he's going to have to take care of. He's going to have to treat her equally to himself. When you take in a Hebrew slave, he's got to have the same quality pillow you have. When you drink wine, he's got to have the same quality wine you drink. Meaning the Torah demands you treat a Hebrew slave as a brother, as an equal. So that's why the Talmud uses the term, kana evet, kana adon latzmo. You bought a servant, you bought a master. You didn't buy a servant, you're obligated to him. You bought a liability. So they didn't get that much money when they sold themselves as servants. But this was a way that a father could ensure that his daughter would be taken care of. And it's even better than that. What the Torah did was the Torah said, when you buy a Jewish girl as a servant in your home, remember, you can only do this to a minor, only a girl under the age of 12. Over the age of 12, she's her own boss. She can do whatever she wants. Under the age of 12, the Torah says the money you pay for that girl, that money is kiddushin money. Meaning you paid, you bought her. But the Torah says, from my perspective, if you want to marry her, then that money was already the engagement ring. So the Torah wants the mindset of the master, of the boss, to be, I'm already half married to her. Technically, the second I decide I'm marrying her, then I already did it. The money, the Torah biblically said, that the money you paid, it has the halakhic status of an engagement ring the second you decide it. A biblical engagement ring, not like today's engagement ring. What you see being done under the chuppah, a biblical engagement. What we give, what we call engagement isn't biblical. It's just, we call it, we're getting engaged. Biblical engagement is what happens under the chuppah. He puts the ring on her hand and says, Arei at mikudesh at li, you are hereby betrothed to me with this ring, etc. So that's biblical. From that moment onward, she's biblically married to him. There's only a technical next step that has to happen. So the money he pays when he purchases this girl makes her biblically his wife the second he chooses, either his or his son's. Now what the Torah did here was the Torah allowed this girl to go up the social ladder, to take a leap up the social ladder. Here she is, she's born to this impoverished family where they can't even feed her. Her father is on the verge of dying. Everyone's suffering from malnutrition. And she's living in a palace. She's not only living in a palace wearing a princess's clothing, but the master has a special mitzvah to marry her, either himself or one of his children. And they're going to spend the next 6 years seeing her skill, seeing her charm. Where would a girl, on her social setting, where would she ever get a date with a guy like this? Never. Why would he date a girl like this in a million years? But now she's growing up in his home. So he gains, he gets a servant. She gains, she gets whatever he's giving his own kids, she gets. And he has a mitzvah for himself, his son, someone in the family to marry her. If at the end of the 6 years, no one does that, she's had 6 years of a normal life. She's already an adult, she's already being well fed, well taken care of. They have a special mitzvah that when she leaves their house to pile gifts upon her to help her get set up in life. Whenever a Hebrew slave leaves, so there's a mitzvah to give him ha'anik ta'anik lo. Give him some of your sheep, give him some of your cattle, give him some of your wealth, to give him gifts when he leaves. So the Torah set up this system to protect the girls and to give them an opportunity to move up in life. Yes?
Or she was incredibly abused. I mean, this is the kind of justification that other societies use for child marriage. But you often find that abuse is more common than protection.
Two things. A, it's, first of all, historically, that's not the way it happened by us. And secondly, what they did was, traditionally, the girl would get married legally at age 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and stay at her father's house. She wouldn't move in with her husband till 14, 16, 18.
So she wouldn't be halachically
married. Halachically, she was married. Practically, they weren't living with her. Practically, they weren't intimate. She was still growing up by her own parents, so long as her father was alive. But it was a security that she was married and she was being taken care of. And if necessary, that there was a husband to take care of her. If the father was killed in a pogrom, so then she had someone who was responsible for her. And the father wouldn't have to worry about a dowry or anything else. She's set.
Are there any cases of child marriage within Jewish society today?
Yeah. What do you call a child? Under 18? Yes. Under 12? Not to the best of my knowledge. It's wrong. The Talmud prohibits it. Technically, legally, you could do it, but the Talmud says it's a terrible father that'll do it. The Talmud says it's wrong. A father should wait till the child is old enough to say who she wants to marry. The only reason, so then why do we have that strength? That we're given that capacity because there were dire circumstances. And I'm telling you that I have guys in the Hesder Yeshiva where I teach who told me that their grandmothers got married this way. That the Muslims would abduct any girl that wasn't married, and their own grandmothers, who are still alive today at age 4 or 5, were wed to someone. They grew up in their father's house till age 14, and then at 14 or 16, at some point, they moved into their husband's house. But legally, they were wed at age 4 or less. but think of the inverse. If they wouldn't do that, they knew she'd be abducted by a Muslim. What choice did they have? Yeah.
But it actually happens still today in Yemen.
Yeah?
Yeah, Muslims respect that if someone, if a girl is engaged or married, so that's how much they do it.
Okay. Now, the Torah says, let's say the master bought this Jewish girl, and she's growing up in his house, and then he or his son says, she's a great girl, I want to marry her. He marries her. And then he takes on a second wife. Remember, biblically, you're allowed to marry more than one wife, unless there's an understanding, like today, that you won't do it. But technically, biblically, it's permitted. So the Torah says, but you got to be careful. You still owe this girl the same food you owed her. You still owe her the same beautiful clothing. You still owe her the same amount of romantic time. And here, the Torah indicates to us what are the biblical obligations of every husband towards his wife. Meaning when the Torah says, don't reduce what you give her. Don't look down at her and say, well, I bought her, so she's only my second wife. No, you owe her the same that you owed her before. Just, she's your wife. And here the Torah defines, what does a husband owe his wife? He owes her food, he owes her clothing, he owes her romantic time together. Now, part of food, by the way, is part of clothing, part of food is getting her makeup. And this is where the Shulchan Aruch says that a woman's supposed to wear makeup. Because it says part of what you owe a wife and the food you give her included is also makeup. So you see, it's a given in halacha that women will wear makeup. I'm sorry, guys, but in certain crowds you're going to date. They didn't teach them that. They're going to show up to the dates without makeup. They think that's a level of piety. But what can you do? In Shulchan Aruch it says not that way.
Is there not a level of piety to not wear makeup?
What's pious about not being beautiful?
Does makeup necessarily indicate that you're beautiful or not?
Oh, you're right. A person can deck themselves out and put on makeup in a way that's immodest. But a person can also use makeup to touch themselves up and look nicer.
Could a person put on makeup and still be beautiful and that's just it seems more real and
could be.
And everything?
Could be. It says that that's how Sarah was. Sarah Imenu. It says she was beautiful at age 20 like a 7-year-old. So the commentaries say usually a 20-year-old is nicer than a 7-year-old. What's the verse telling us? It's telling us just like a 7-year-old has natural beauty and she doesn't need makeup, so too Sarah at age 7, at age 20, had natural beauty. She didn't need makeup. That's okay. the Torah tells us that if someone kills someone else, he gets a death penalty. What happens if he does it by mistake? So then the Torah says we have cities of refuge where a person may run away to those cities and then he has to stay there in order to stay alive. We have a special commandment that a person cannot take refuge religiously from paying justice. Meaning if a person murdered and then he runs to the altar, he can't say, oh, I'm by the altar, I'm serving God, leave me alone. We don't consider that. No, the Torah specifically says, take him from the altar and administer whatever penalty he deserves. We have a special commandment, one who smites his parents gets the death penalty. And the idea here is one who lets blood, who causes his parents to bleed. Now, What happens if a person's a dentist and his father needs dental treatment? So we say, try to get a different dentist. Tell the other dentist, I'll treat your dad, you treat my dad. What happens if you're the only competent dentist in town? So then you have to treat your father, but you have to be careful not to cause him to bleed one iota more than necessary. But the truth is that that's true not only about a dentist, that's true about any doctor. Any doctor treating any patient has a biblical obligation, it seems, to be careful not to cause him to bleed any more than necessary. And that's why when we do a tafat dam brit, when a person has a circumcision that's not kosher, either it was done before the 8th day, or it was done at night, or it was done by someone not Jewish or not religious, so then we say, what are you going to do? He's circumcised already. So the halacha says, you let one drop of blood from the area of the circumcision, it's not painful, you don't even feel it. One drop of blood, and that converts the whole circumcision to be a kosher one. Now, when we do it, we're very careful to let the smallest drop of blood, because if you make a big drop of blood, so you made him bleed more than necessary. And that's prohibited. But that's true for any doctor. Yes?
Wasn't actual bloodletting a common medical practice back then?
For medicine, that's permissible. Correct. Just like you can donate blood. Anything that's medicinal, that's beneficial to the patient. Any amount of blood that's beneficial or necessary to the patient is a mitzvah. Anything beyond that, so you do the best you can. You don't have to do more than the best you can. But anything you could have prevented, that's prohibited. We have the idea of kidnapping, where a person gets a death penalty for kidnapping. We have the concept where one who curses his parents gets a death penalty. And then we have the concept of human responsibility. So the first thing we have to know is the idea that humans are responsible. Right? Human beings are responsible. The idea, I didn't mean to do it, I'm very sorry, that doesn't hold water. So I understand you didn't mean to do it. You're still going to have to pay. I once brought a suit from the cleaners, and someone walked by and knocked the suit down into the mud. So now I got to pay all the money of the cleaners again, right? So the guy said, gee, I'm really sorry. That's very nice that you're really sorry, but you still have to pay. You know, you damaged someone, the halacha says, the fact that you didn't mean to do it doesn't absolve you. If a person caused negligence to someone else, they have to pay. It's a foreign concept today. People think, but I didn't mean it. So what? But it's not my fault. Okay, but if we cause damage to someone else, even if it's not our fault, if we did it, person says, you know, I was running by, I didn't notice your glasses, I knocked it over. Okay, but I was in a rush. I understand, you still have to pay. Those are not good excuses. The Torah says that a person has to pay. Nezek, tsar, sheves, ripui, boshes. Damages are divided into five concepts. Nezek, the damages. Let's say the guy was a computer programmer and he hacked off one of his hands. I'm really sorry, I was trying to hack the tree, I didn't notice your hand there. Okay, but now he can work half the work as a computer programmer. He can do half, he's half as productive. So we evaluate that and you have to pay for that. Tsar, the person's pain. We evaluate that, he has to pay that. We evaluate if a person had to undergo the same procedure with anesthesia or without. How much would he pay for the anesthesia? So you have to pay that. Ripui, the medical bills. Let's say you tell him, I'll get you a free doctor. So the halacha says, well, the guy could say, I don't want a free doctor. Free medicine, you get what you pay for. That's what they learned in Russia. That's why at the height of the Cold War, Khrushchev came here to get treated for cancer. Khrushchev, what's wrong with you? You're the one who's saying communism is the best, right? So what are you going flying into New York to get treated for cancer? Answer, he knew full well that you get what you pay for. And so the top treatment was in New York. So ripui, you have to pay for the medical bills. Boshet, the shame. You know, sometimes a person can smack someone in front of everyone else. So the guy turns bright red, he's all embarrassed, takes him to court. The guy says, what did I do? So I smacked you. No, the halacha says you got to pay for that shame. So those are the five concepts of payment for damages. Torah says if a person kills a servant, so then he gets a death penalty. We have ways of estimating whether he did it, he didn't do it. Torah says if a person caused a woman to miscarry, so then he has to pay. The Torah says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot, a burn for a burn, a wound for a wound. We don't do that. So we have tradition on how to interpret the Torah. We do not do an eye for an eye. Our tradition is that you evaluate the value of the eye and you pay for it. So the verse says an eye for an eye, and we don't do it. That's phenomenal. That's tradition. And no one argues. Throughout our tradition, we always said an eye for an eye doesn't mean literally. So that's the power of tradition. If a person knocks out an eye or a tooth of a non-Jewish slave, so then the slave goes free. Yes?
How can you evaluate the value of somebody's eye? What if right now they're using it for West, then they could be, but maybe in like 5 years they would have been on a different level of using it for like much more things than they do right now.
Right. That's a good point. I don't know.
If you're a rodeo host, you don't need to go by it. But if you're a pirate, mm-hmm. So if you lose your job by it, you can also go do it that way.
But he's saying it could be in 5 years he would have been a pilot. Right now he isn't a pilot. So how can you evaluate the loss of a limb? The loss is a long-term loss. Whatever evaluation you're going to do now, he's saying, isn't fair. Because you can't evaluate what his potential would have been long-term.
Then he has to be in the middle of taking the course of fire.
So he's saying that's not fair. Right. So I want to say if. Right. And why not? I think his claim is fair. I can tell you I was hit by a car as a kid. And when the insurance paid, the insurance had to evaluate what are the odds of what I would suffer long term from that injury that I suffered then. And they were right. They said I'd have to undergo surgery. I already underwent surgery twice because of an accident when I was 13 years old. So I'm only 34 and I already underwent surgery twice because of that accident. They were right. And they evaluated long term. So he's saying there are certain things you can't evaluate long term. He's right. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. Right, but I don't know how that's even evaluated.
The way they did with you, which happened to seemingly be...
Right, but the halacha doesn't say that.
What does it say? I mean,
it says you evaluate him as a servant, and you evaluate how much was he worth beforehand, and how much is he worth now. So you could say part of the evaluation is that this servant could potentially do all of that, but I'm not sure. You know, the question's a good question. I don't know. Yeah, Larry.
Yeah, I think that's the same, like if you have to damage someone's car, right? Like someone has a car, and the car has a book price. He has a Mercedes, and it has a book price of X. Now, you don't know that in 20 years there might be a classic car, and because you bumped into his car, now he's not going to get a good price for his classic car in 20 years' time. No, you pay the book price today. It becomes a classic car. Too bad.
I hear what you're saying. I hear. Yeah.
But he didn't become a servant because he wanted to be a pirate.
No, we evaluate him as if he would be. Meaning if someone would buy him. So I guess that's built into the price. If you buy a servant, you're buying the odds of the potential that he might be a pilot, and you'll make that money off of him. So I'm saying whatever those odds are, I guess that's included in the price. I guess that's the answer. I guess.
There's two kinds of servants, the one who stole and the one who wanted to be a servant. Is
right.
The same case? Or?
I think the idea is a non-Jewish servant, because then we're encompassing what he's saying, the long-term cost. We have the idea of responsibility for our animals. Sorry, yes? When we evaluate, ayin tachat ayin, we say traditionally means the value of the eye. So how do we evaluate it? We say, Joe Schmo, before he had his eye knocked out, what would he have been sold for on the slave market? And now what's he worth on the slave market? So that's how we evaluate the damage aspect of the eye.
Doesn't the eye in Tachareim part have to do with
I don't think so. Look at the pasuk. Look at the context. It's talking about two people fighting, and one damages the other, or the other one's wife.
But the non-Jew slave is pretty much for life slave.
Right, that's why I'm saying the cost must cover that aspect, because it's for life. Right, it's covering... what's the life expectancy, what's the productivity expectancy. Right, so the price probably covers that aspect too. Yes?
But I thought we said anyway the price of the servant wasn't very high.
A Jewish servant. I said a Jewish servant. Here we're evaluating him in the non-Jewish slave market. Okay, we have responsibility for our animals. So the first responsibility is not to have a damaging animal. You're not allowed to buy a dog that's going to bite everyone. And if you buy such a dog, you have to tie him up in a way that everyone who sees him knows that he's tied up and isn't scared. I used to live on Herzl 62 down here. And the way to our apartment was, there were a series of buildings. And you had to walk up off the street and then walk down a dark path till you hit the entrance to our building. And across that path lived a man who had a dog that had a very loud bark. And every night, my wife and I would come home at different times, we'd walk down that path and pray the dog was tied. He always was, but we never knew. We couldn't see. It was dark. All we heard was the dog charging and biting. We'd always have to pray that he's going to stop, that the leash would catch him. That's prohibited. Now, Halacha says you're not allowed to scare people. It's not enough that you muzzle the animal. It has to be a muzzle that everyone sees. So we're not allowed to have something that's damaging to other people. And we're responsible for our animals. If an ox gores someone, so then the ox gets a death penalty. That's an interesting concept. Something that is a source of harm gets removed from the world. So there was a terrible story. Cute little boy, 3-4-year-old, really, really cute, was playing in the yard, and the neighbors had a vicious dog, and the dog ran up and bit the kid's face off. And the kid was hospitalized, and they stitched up whatever they could, but the kid went in 1 minute from being a cute, sweet little kid to a kid whose whole face was totally deranged. So the father of the kid went home, pulled out his rifle, went over to the neighbor, and blasted the dog's brains out. And when I heard the story, I heard it from the doctor who treated the kid, I said, way to go! That's the halacha, the ox that killed. You don't go saying, well. No, the halacha says, the ox gored. So you say, innocent animal. So here there's a very, very interesting discussion among the commentaries. Why does the ox get killed? So some of the commentaries say, the ox is held liable. Really? But oxen don't have free will. So this is a big discussion. There's a commentary in Nachmanides which discusses, do we really hold the ox liable? Because Maimonides wants to say it's all about the owner. We want the owner to learn his lesson. That's why we kill the ox. Nachmanides says, if that's the reason, then how come the halacha says that even if it's an ox of hefker, even if it's an ox that has no owner, it gets killed? There is no owner. Who are you teaching the lesson to? So Nachmanides says something which I don't understand. They say that Nachmanides meant to say that the ox gets a punishment. I don't see that in the words of Nachmanides. I'm not sure what he does mean to say. But that's how they want to interpret what Nachmanides says. The Torah says that an owner has to know that if he has an ox that's damaging, so then the owner is going to get the death penalty at the hands of heaven. Meaning, if he knows that this ox is an ox that's killed, and he can prevent it, or he should have at least killed the ox, he left that ox lying around his house, so he gets a death penalty. The Torah says that if one uncovers a pit, or one digs a pit, so he has to pay damages. So it's very interesting. We learn this halacha, and how many times do we stop to think about it? It blows me away. I can walk down a busy street and see a sewer cover off the pit. That's a danger. No one bothers calling. How come? It's wrong. That's this halacha. You walk by a pit, you have to deal with it. You can't walk by a pit and leave it uncovered. And you'll say, but it's public domain. What's it my responsibility? Well, what's it his responsibility? I was once walking by a construction site where they had they were constructing a building, which must have been about 50, 70 feet deep. They were laying the foundations. And they put a fence at the edge of the block so no one could fall into the big construction hole there where they were working down there. But the fence shifted. So there were holes along the way where people could fall 70 feet and get killed. So I'm walking by, and this is a block where you have maybe 500 kids walking down that block. There's two schools at the end of the block. And no one bothered calling the city. So the rest of the day, I spent the next 4 hours that morning by that construction site to make sure no one falls down until the city came down and ensured that they moved the fence. Now, I didn't think I was doing an act of piety. I don't think we're allowed to walk by when there's a danger in the street. That's the idea of a bor. There's a pit. If someone uncovers a pit, he's responsible for it. If we walk by and see a pit, so we should deal with it. Sometimes you walk by and there are slippery steps here at the Machon. So someone could break their head on those steps. So you can dry it, and sometimes you can't dry it. So at least put up a sign, slippery when wet. Or get someone else to put up the sign. But there's this idea of responsibility. The Torah gives us the concept of paying a tax. If someone steals an ox or a sheep, they have to pay 4 or 5 times the value of the 4 times the sheep, 5 times the ox. And then the Torah gives us another halacha. What happens if a person sees someone breaking into his house? So the Torah says you could kill him. That's a very interesting halacha. The halacha says the assumption is that when someone's breaking into your house, he knows that you're not going to sit idly by and let him walk off with your belongings. So the understanding is that he knows that you're going to stand up and put up a fight, and he's ready to kill you. And here in Israel now, in Beit Shemesh, they're building Beit Shemesh Gimel or Dalid. They brought in a few hundred illegal Arab workers. They all sleep in the construction site. Now all of Beit Shemesh is rampant with theft. You have the same thing in many cities here in Israel, where people will wake up in the middle of the night and they'll hear rummaging in their kitchen, and they walk out and they see an Arab there. One guy told me, he walked into the kitchen and the Arab looked up and saw him. So you'd think the guy would run away. He picked up a kitchen knife. So the guy waved goodbye, walked into his room and locked the door. Sat there praying that the guy wouldn't touch his kids. Once he was in the room and locked the door, he realized, my kids are in the other room. And he didn't have a phone. Okay, it blew me away that he stayed in his room. I don't know how he did that. People are encountering this over and over again. They walk in and they see there are Arabs stealing from a lot of homes these days. I don't know if you guys know what's going on. But
No.
Because what's happening, like in Beit Shemesh, is that these people are illegal in the country. They can't travel in and out all the time. So what they do is they camp out. They camp out where they're going to get food from. What they need is your tuna fish. They need your pots and pans. They're working in illegal construction by night.
There's an obligation, obviously, if he's going to do that. He's ultimately responsible.
What, you think he cares?
It's legal, like in Texas and Louisiana. You can legally shoot someone for that. Now, there are tragedies. There was a Japanese exchange student who went to the wrong house by mistake years back and got killed. You know, then his brother came at home. But that's you know, again, for the common good, what do you...
So the Torah says here, you... If you see someone breaking into your house, you could, but...
I think here they have a law now called the Gideon's Law, or someone, because the veteran kept stealing this guy's sheep, and finally they made it legal that you could shoot him and stop.
I don't know where it's holding now. But the Torah does say, if things were clear, then you can't kill. What does that mean? If a son sees his father coming to steal from him, then he's not allowed to kill. Meaning if he can be confident that the thief is not going to kill him. So here you have a kid who sees his father breaking into his house to steal from him. And the Torah says in normal circumstances, the son can be confident even though the father might steal from him, he'd never kill him. That's a normal situation. It's not so normal that the father's stealing, but at that much, the Torah does assume that even though he might steal from him, he wouldn't. He wouldn't kill him. That's the old mafia line, right? Why should you always work with family? Because when we're all stealing from one another, at least the money stays in the family. Yes?
I was going to ask, regarding your ability to kill someone, if they're breaking into your house,
It would be quite dangerous in the sense that you could have you'd be locked out of your house or something and don't want to pick your family up or something. And maybe they happen to be up and see someone trying to hop the fence into the garage window or something, whatever it might be, and they shoot.
Sure. You're 100% right. I could tell you a lot of stories just like that that I know personally firsthand. Right? It's a very dangerous thing. You're right.
So why is it halacha if it's so dangerous?
I guess we have to be responsible, do our best. The halacha discusses someone digging to get into your house. But you're right. There can be circumstances where a person has to know what he's doing. I can sit here for the rest of the class and tell you stories. That I know the people involved firsthand where one guy almost shot his wife. The next guy, the wife almost shot the husband. The third guy, it was one of the kids. The fourth guy, in all these cases, they had Baruch Hashem happy endings, but the fourth guy, he's lying in a caravan and he hears someone jiggling with the door and he cocks his gun and he's sitting there waiting with the gun pointed at the door. And he's asking himself, should I shoot through the door or should I wait till he walks in? And it turns out it was someone who he had lent a package to. The guy got up real early to go daven. And he came and was tying onto the handle of the door the thing he had borrowed to give it back. He was tying it onto the handle of the door. And he's sitting there with his gun ready to shoot. He hears the jiggling of the handle. There are many stories. You're right.
Story where the brother killed his brother. By mistake. Sure. Because the brother was somewhere out. Late in the night, and he didn't want the parents to discover that he came late, so he sneaked him somewhere in the house, and the brother got scared, and he thought he was an Arab entering, so he shot him afterwards, tragically, that he was his brother. It was in a yeshuv, I think, next to Gebel Yitzchak, Kibbutz, but 2 years back.
Yeah, so you have a good point.
But it's a different situation. It's tragedy. He didn't deserve to be shot. It's nothing I have to say. It's a tragedy. But if he had said, okay, what can the parents do to me if they find out I was somewhere I shouldn't be coming?
Yeah, but you also...
Like, should have done the doorbell and,
I don't know. A tough call. I agree. It can happen.
Like in the 22 would have been a boy. That's what I'm meaning.
I hear. I don't know. Top. The Torah tells us that there are different levels of payment. So today we live in a society where you pay with money, but this is quickly changing now. Let's say you owe someone money, and you tell him, "Okay, I'll give you a check." Is that legitimate? Do you have to pay cash? Let's say you tell the person, okay, I'm going to deposit yens into your account. Well, the yen is fluctuating like crazy. The Bank of Japan just notified they're going to reduce the value of the yen. What can you pay him with? Can you pay him with gold bars, silver bars? Can you pay him with dollars, with shekels, with Swiss francs? So the Torah actually gives us a ladder. Depending on what the circumstance, there's a biblical responsibility, what value you have to pay. Meaning what you either have to pay, the Talmud divides it into idios, benonios, iborios. You have three levels, the best, the middle, and the worst. Where let's say you owe someone money. So you remember, in the days up until recently, money had less value than goods. Because you couldn't get everything. Meaning, you could be a millionaire and you needed a gold button and there was no one in town to sell you a gold button. So now all that money doesn't help you very much because assets were hard to come by. The products were hard to come by. So you were better off having products than money. Money's only as good as what it can buy. Like in Russia, you had a lot of money. You didn't have bread at the bakery. Didn't help you all the money. So that's the way the world looked like up until this century. People would pay their debts with a lot of things other than money. The question is, can you come to someone, you owe a person money, your animal destroyed part of their field, and you say, no problem, buddy. I got 500 pounds of dung in my yard. that has value. I'll bring it to your yard. Go sell it. So the halacha discusses when it comes to damages, you have to pay top quality, top dollar. One who caused damages, meitav sadeh, he has to pay the best crops. Yes.
You mentioned slavery when we started out. I mean, this would seem to be the most common way. I mean, generally speaking, certainly today, and I would imagine then too, the people that do these thefts don't have the money to pay. It's one reason they're doing the thefts. And it doesn't make it right, of course. But, you know, the idea that it seems, first of all, one of the glaring things is there's no imprisonment ever mentioned here. So that, obviously, today, for some reason, we do that just to get him off the street. It doesn't seem to be a very good solution. I mean, it costs us a lot of money, keep him in prison. Doesn't seem to rehabilitate anybody. So that seems to be a mess. But the idea of servitude, where they have to do something, whether it's put in a camp somewhere or whatever, it doesn't necessarily have to be in your house if you don't want it. Like with the child, who stays in his own home until a certain age, seems like a better system in many respects.
I hear.
You know, it's kind of glaring because you talk about paying more and paying it off, but unless you're a white collar Wall Street kind of swindler, usually you don't have the money to pay when you get caught.
We have the mitzvah of covering costs when one made a fire. And here the Talmud really goes into physics. The Talmud discusses forces, vector forces. When the Talmud discusses the concept of fire in halacha is really a concept of what damages one does through force. And an example of this is when the Talmud discusses you shoot an arrow. So the Talmud discusses the propelling force that moves it forward, the force that moves it perpendicular, and the force that moves it horizontal. Is it you shoot an arrow up? So the Talmud breaks it down. The Talmud says there's a force that's moving upward, there's a force that's moving forward. Then when the arrow starts going down, how much of that is you're doing? How much of that is nature's doing? What happened when a wind moves it? And it's fascinating looking at how the Talmud breaks down what we learn from the laws of fire, and from here we derive all the laws of energy. The laws discussing my responsibility for a fire that I light. Now what happens? What moves the fire? A wind comes and moves the fire. So I've started an energy, and that energy keeps moving, and the Torah holds me accountable. So this concept of my responsibility for the damages that a fire I light cause teaches us the halachic concept of energy. It teaches us where, when we propel energy, how much of that energy is called our own doing. If the Torah says, you have to write a Sefer Torah. Well, what happens if I push a button and then the printing machine writes up a Sefer Torah? Is that called me doing it? It's my energy. It's an extension of my energy. I want to make machine matzahs. The Torah says you have to make matzah for the sake of the mitzvah of matzah. Is that called I did it? I want to tan hides for tefillin. You have to tan the hides, you have to prepare the hides for the sake of the mitzvah. Can I do it with a machine? It's my energy. Again, so the idea of energy, the idea of force, and when the force is attributed to the one who perpetrated the force, so all those halachos are learned from this, the concept of a fire. When you light a fire and the external force of wind moves it. We have the laws of people who take responsibility. You run a garage, people pay you to watch their cars. If there's a theft, what are your responsibilities? If there's a forced break-in. So we have four types of responsibility. We have a shomer chinam, one who watches for free. You tell your neighbor, I gotta leave for Shabbos. I do this all the time. There were many thefts in our neighborhood, so when I leave for Shabbos, I leave my tefillin by a neighbor. I'll leave things that I'm worried about by a neighbor. Now the neighbor isn't charging me for it. What are their responsibilities? Let's say they took my tefillin. Okay, we shouldn't talk about my tefillin. But let's say a person who's watching something leaves the door unlocked. He leaves it out where anyone can take it. He leaves it on his porch where anyone can access it. So that's called negligence. And then even someone who isn't getting paid is responsible for negligence. They have to pay for negligence. So we have a range. We have a person who watches for free. We have a shomer sachar, one who's being paid to watch. We have a socher, one who rents it. And then we have a shoel, one who borrows it. Your neighbor borrows your iron and it dies on him. What's his liability? So in our parsha, the Torah defines. One of the things the Torah covers is what happens if your neighbor comes and says it was stolen. I'm really sorry. You left for Shabbos. You took your 1865 mint condition. Indian head penny. It's worth, it's worth a pretty penny. You gave it to him to watch, and he says, okay, no problem. You come back after Shabbos, he says it was stolen. Now, you'd like to believe him, but you realize that on the market, he can make a few tens of thousands of dollars off that penny. So you wonder, did he pocket it or not? So there's a special vow. We have three biblical vows. The first one we encounter in our parsha, where a person who is watching something from someone else has to make a biblical vow that he didn't pocket it. There's a vow that he has to take. When he says it was stolen, he has to take a vow he didn't pocket it. Then we have the laws of one who borrows it. And that brings us to Pasuk Tesvav. We finished about half the parsha. To be continued maybe tomorrow night.